Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 9. Daniel Patterson. About 3 miles from Sanbunton Bridge to the west, at the point where the Pemigewasset and the Winnipesaukee rivers unite to form the Merrimack, is the little town of Franklin. Even in the middle of last century, famous or infamous, according to the political views held, as the birthplace of Daniel Webster. It was in those days, as it still is to a very large extent, the shopping center for all the district round about. Sanbunton Bridge drove down the Winnipesaukee River, and Webster and such like places drove down the Pemigewasset to do their shopping in Franklin. It was a thriving mill town with unlimited water power in the hills just at hand and right in its very midst. All that Sanbunton had, Franklin had. Only, in addition to its industries, it had its merchants and its craftsmen, its doctors and its lawyers who cared for the needs of the countryside. Among the doctors of Franklin, in the days when Mary Glover was living in her sister Abigail's house at Sanbunton, was one Daniel Patterson. He was primarily a dentist, but like so many dentists in those days, he had made some study of the then rebel art of homeopathy and practiced it on the side. His headquarters were at Franklin, but his practice extended much further afield, and sometimes for a week or more at a time, he would take the road on horseback, and having previously advertised his coming, would move from one little town to another, take a room, generally provided for such purposes in the local hotel, and attend to such patients as came to him. It was quite a common practice in New England in the middle of last century. Daniel Patterson was a good dentist, and within a short time of his settling in Franklin, was apparently much in demand. He was a distant relative of the new Mrs. Mark Baker of Sanbunton, and it was probably because of this connection that Mary Glover came to know him. The acquaintance was, at first, purely professional. The art of filling teeth was rapidly improving and was being resorted to increasingly in preference to the time-honored method of tooth-pulling. And Mary, who was evidently having trouble with her teeth, had gone to him for professional service. On December 12, 1852, she writes to him very formally, "Mr. Patterson, dear sir," and asks him if he thinks that the teeth he had examined should be filled at once. She is evidently anxious that this be done, as she adds half humorously, "I would like to retain as long as possible all I have left. Never knowing before the loss of teeth, I was ignorant of all the difficulties I find attend it." The tone of the letter, in spite of its formal opening, suggests that the two already knew each other quite well. And it is, of course, probable that through his relationship with Mrs. Baker, Dr. Patterson had been a visitor in the Baker and Tilton households at Sanbunton. He was a personable man, tall and broad-shouldered, with excellent features and full-flowing black beard. He was, moreover, something of a dandy, dressed in broadcloth with varnished boots, and affected at all times the formal fashion of the day, a silk top hat. He seems from the first to have been determined to marry the young widow at Sanbunton, and the stars in their courses aided him. Quite apart from the separation from her boy, Mary's position in her sister's house was one particularly galling to a woman of her temperament. Abigail Tilton was coming to be a great lady, and in those acutely political days, her home at Sandbutton was naturally the headquarters for vigorous political discussion of all kinds, generally centering round the ever-inflammable question of slavery. The Tiltons were good Northern Democrats. They did not like slavery and would not have tolerated it in any circumstances in their own state or home. But they believed profoundly in states' rights, and any act or manner of speech which savored of a willingness to invade these rights for any reason whatsoever was regarded by them as something very like treason. Mary also was a good Democrat, but she had been brought in contact with slavery in the South and had been torn ever since between her heartfelt horror of the whole system and her loyalty to the old Democratic viewpoint. Generally, she seems to have managed to avoid any expression of opinion at the gatherings in her sister's house. But on one occasion, she was directly challenged. The debate had turned to the question of slavery, and what would be the effect of the election of Franklin Pierce, a strong Democrat, to the presidency. One of the guests asked Mrs. Glover her views. She might have passed it by, but for some reason she determined to make a clean breast of it. Franklin Pierce was her friend, and not only her friend, but her childhood's hero. Nevertheless, she did not hesitate. She believed, she said, that not only the North, but the South suffered from the continuance of slavery and its spread to other states, that the election of Franklin Pierce would tend to inflame the situation, and she did not think that his election would benefit the country as a whole. Abigail Tilton was aghast, but when she asked Mary how she dared make such a statement in her house, Mary replied quite firmly that she dared say what she believed in any house. Such was the situation, as far as Mary was concerned, in the early part of 1853, when Daniel Patterson was pressing his suit. He had formally proposed in March, but had been refused. Romance entered into the average New England marriage in those days only on a level with many other considerations. Marriages were contracted, especially second marriages, with deliberation, and considerations of expediency were given much weight. Mary had an unhappy home. She was entirely dependent on her sister. She was separated from her child, and she was wretchedly ill most of the time. Daniel Patterson, the breezy optimist, told Mary and Abigail and Mark as well that homeopathy was just the thing to cure her of her ills, that in the case of anyone so finely strung as Mary, the highest attenuations would work miracles, and that if she would marry him, he would treat her and she would get well. There is no reason to doubt that he believed all he said. The effect his marriage to the beautiful daughter of Mark Baker might have upon his practice may have had something to do with it. It would not have been New England in the middle of last century if it had not. But there seems to be no doubt that Mary attracted him enormously. And with his usual optimism, he evidently felt sure that all the rest would follow. Their not inconsiderable correspondence shows that Mary was not immune to his charms either. He almost failed, however. Early in April, Mary refused what was evidently another petition. Some differences as to religion had arisen between them, for Mary writes that she cannot yield her religion to his. I could not. She adds, other things compared to this are but a grain to the universe. But by the end of the month, she had given in and accepted him. No doubt Abigail had something to do with it. Mary's marriage would quite clearly solve many problems for her, although there had always been a strong bond of sympathy between them. Mary's unorthodox political views and the constant reproach presented by Mary's separation from her son rendered the proposed change a most desirable one from Abigail's point of view. Mary happily married, reunited with her son, and living at the convenient distance of Franklin was, she must have thought, just as it should be. Mark Baker was not so sure. He would naturally desire the marriage for much the same reasons as would Abigail, but Daniel Patterson was not the kind of man to appeal to Mark Baker. He might have forgiven the varnished boots and the Prince Albert coat, but he was not quite sure of Daniel's religious views. In Mary's vigorous doubts, which almost brought disaster at one point, it seems reasonable to detect a strong parental pressure. There is no doubt that her father did at one time very much disapprove of the match on the grounds of Daniel's religion or lack of it. He also seems to have entertained grave uncertainties as to the entire excellence of the doctor's character. Patterson's farewell letter to Mary, when she refused his second petition on some grounds of religious difference, shows this very clearly. I thought, he writes from Franklin, on Monday morn, April 11th, 1853, I would at first vindicate my moral character and prepared a letter for your father's perusal. But on more mature deliberation, and knowing that you had become dissatisfied with my disposition and wished, yes, had already irrevocably dismissed me, I concluded to withhold all I had written. However, he did not destroy the letter of vindication which seemed so good on Sunday night, but so doubtful on Monday morning, for after Mary had relented, he showed it to her. It is still preserved, dated Franklin, April 10th, 1853. Daniel is clearly very much hurt. Instead of Dear Mary, it is Mary M. Glover, and he plunges at once into the midst of things. Much to my surprise, I learn that your family object to our union on grounds new and strange to me. You say they have heard dark things. And then, in the sonorous and almost melodramatic style of the day, with a heavy interlarding of biblical and poetical metaphors, he says he cannot guess what these dark things are with which his name is besmirched, but that he is sure of their source in some low cesspool of slanderous suspicion, down which Lucifer plunged his hydra head and dividing hoof. when, even if the archangel issued forth from the very throne of God, he would not be spared the whiplash of innuendo and falsehood. There is more to the same purpose, and amazing as it sounds to modern ears, it must perhaps be regarded as sincere enough. At any rate, when he finally reaches his vindication, Daniel is nothing if not wholly without reserve. He offers to take her father around to all the places where he has stayed to check on the nature of his irreproachable conduct. He will take him to his native town to meet clergymen and businessmen and social leaders who have long known and dealt with me, who have known him from infancy upwards, in fact, some of them being members of the Congregational Church, to which the Bakers subscribed, and not blood relations of his either. If he will take the trouble to go, I will bear his expenses, or I will give him any number of reliable names whom he may address in the matter. It certainly seems full enough to satisfy Mark Baker, for in the end he seems to have approved the match heartily, and with the aid of the new Mrs. Baker, who had a real affection for Mary, prepared for the wedding to be held from the Baker homestead. They were married on June 21, 1853, and after some delay went to live in Franklin. Dr. Patterson's macabre-like optimism carried all before it at first. He bought a little house in Franklin, furnished it, mainly with things Mary brought with her from Sandbutton, and engaged a housekeeper. But he quickly revealed the defects of his superficially attractive virtues. His claims were always ahead of his achievements. His varnished boots, Prince Albert coat, and silk hat were always really in the world of his dreams. He could see Daniel Patterson clothed in them in a thousand different engaging situations. But his dreams often had rude awakenings, and he was in the dust until he could dream again. Squire Baker of Sandbutton was by this time a quite important figure throughout the countryside, and Dr. Patterson's marriage to his daughter certainly would give him, Daniel, added prestige. He apparently made much of it, but only socially. He gave up his journeyings abroad in search of business, sold his horse, and settled down to living all the time in Franklin. He had not enough work, however. The good people of Franklin soon reached the limits of their modest dental demands, and his practice steadily dwindled. Meanwhile, Mary did not get any better, and within a few weeks of her marriage suffered her first cruel disappointment. Daniel Patterson was unwilling that her little son should come to live with them, we are told by Mrs. Eddy in her book Retrospection and Introspection. "My dominant thought," she writes, "in marrying again, was to get back my child. But after our marriage, his stepfather was not willing he should have a home with me." Mary, however, never lost hope. She did her best to make a home for Daniel Patterson, and for a time the outlook was not so bad. Mary had again a home of her own, and all her life she had a faculty for making much out of very little in the matter of her surroundings. The townspeople called upon her, and she returned their calls. But for her, The whole atmosphere of those days must have been one of disappointment. She was sick. Before they were married, Patterson had held out hope of recovery under his care that accounted almost to a promise. The months that followed, stretching out into years, were dreary enough. Dr. Patterson was not doing well, and it is hard not to read into the falling off an effect which supervened upon his marriage, a disappointment that his wife's rich relations had done nothing for them. It would be a mistake, however, to assume that the situation was entirely unrelieved. Daniel Patterson may have had many faults, but deliberate unkindness was not one of them. It took very little to raise his spirits, for the moment at least, and when thus raised, the whole world rose with him, and in his breezy, boisterous way, he could carry conviction as to the new heaven and the new earth to those around him. It was undoubtedly this characteristic which constituted his chief attraction in the eyes of the sorely tried and unsatisfied woman he had made his wife. He had, moreover, a great love of natural beauty. "There was one time in my ride to this place," he wrote to her on one of his journeys from Wolfboro on Lake Winnipesaukee, "when I said to myself, 'Now I wish Mary was with me.' It was on attaining the summit of a hill. The first view of the lake burst upon my vision, with its smooth face scarified and lacerated by numerous islets and points. And yet it was beautiful. Then I really wished you by my side." But when all has been said in his favor that can be said, the picture still remains much the same. Daniel Patterson was a man of many fair-weather friends and no enemies save himself. And during the 3 years that he and Mary lived in Franklin, more and more of his friends tended to pass by on the other side, while the one enemy entrenched himself more firmly than ever as the man in possession. Meanwhile, it does not seem likely that Mark Baker or Abigail Tilton sat idly by and let things drift without any effort to change their course into a better direction. Abigail could not but feel a certain amount of responsibility in the matter. And from the way in which she more than once came to the rescue later on, it is natural to assume that she did what she could. Indeed, it was probably due to Abigail that a plan was ultimately consummated which gave promise to Mary of the fulfillment of her great desire to have her boy with her, or in any case, close at hand. In the hill town of North Groton, where little George was living with Mahala Cheney and her husband, the Tiltons owned a small property, a good house, and land on the outskirts of the town. Through the land ran a little trout stream with an excellent fall, and on the stream was a sawmill. There was a small mortgage on the property, and the plan that was finally worked out was that the equity in the property was transferred to the Pattersons, who, on taking it over, assumed responsibility for the mortgage. The proposition evidently appeared very attractive to Dr. Patterson. For him, it solved more than one problem. His wife would be near her son. The interest on the mortgage was nominal when considered as rent, and a sawmill, properly worked, would provide a welcome addition to the uncertain income derived from his practice. Mary was, of course, overjoyed at the prospect. And so in the spring of 1855, as soon as the roads were passable and the accustomed sudden mildness of coming summer was everywhere, they loaded their household effects onto a wagon and took the road into the hills. It was a climb most of the way, for the town near the entrance of the Franconia range of the White Mountains lies at an elevation of over 1,000 feet. In the middle of last century, North Groton was a thriving community, much smaller than Sandbutton, but considerably larger than Bow. It had a good school, a large general store which catered to the needs of a wide countryside, and it even had a small public library. The Pattersons' new home was not far from the main road, along which the slow-moving ox teams made their way down the hill to the little town of Rumney on the then newly constructed railroad and back again. It was not isolated even in winter, and Mary, who could make a home out of almost anything, had very soon transformed the little unpainted house into a very attractive place in which to live. Years afterwards, she used to declare that she was impatient of a speck of dust. And the few records of her life at North Groton show that somehow, in spite of her burden of continued illness, she managed to secure perfect housekeeping. The records are indeed very scanty, affording only occasional glimpses of the passage of the months running on into years. There is no word of her first meeting with her son, of the visits of Mahala, his foster mother, and her own devoted nurse, of the goings and comings of Patterson, or of the letters which must have passed back and forth between her and Abigail. Such few records as are preserved are, however, strangely revealing, one especially. Shortly after they arrived and settled in, no doubt with the help of Mahala, Dr. Patterson secured a housekeeper. She was efficient enough, but evidently the type of woman who imperatively demanded that things should be run her way. And it was not long before the matter of authority came to an issue. One day, a blind girl came to the house seeking work. And Mrs. Patterson, immediately interested, after talking to her for some time, decided to take her in and see what she could do. In spite of her blindness, she seems to have been remarkably capable and quick to learn. But the housekeeper from the first was profoundly disapproving. Finally, she told Mrs. Patterson, perfectly straightly, that the blind girl would have to go, or else she would. Mrs. Patterson did not hesitate a moment. She let the housekeeper go, and she and the blind girl went on together. The blind girl's name was Myra Smith. She stayed with Mrs. Patterson all the time she was in Groton, and many years afterwards her sister, then a very aged woman, recalled how she used to go to the Patterson's home some two or three times each week to visit Myra, and how Mrs. Patterson was ill nearly all the time. She recalls how the sick woman was always reading, but that whenever she came to her bedside, she would lay aside her book and pat her on the head and say, "Oh, you dear little girl, you are worth your weight in gold. I wish you were mine." She also recalled how one of the greatest pleasures of the children was to carry in the earliest berries and wild flowers to the poor sick lady. Such recollections, scanty as they are, draw aside the curtain a little. As to George and his visits, Myra Smith herself recalled, when a very old woman, how the boy would come to his mother to be helped with his lessons, how his mother loved to have him there, and how he seemed to be always happy with her. Dr. Patterson, however, disapproved these visits, and one day, when he returned home and found the boy with his wife after he had forbidden him to come, he sent him back to the Cheneys with the injunction not to return. It is not known whether the doctor disliked the child, or if, as he has been quoted as saying, he felt the presence of the husky youngster taxed Mary's already overtaxed strength. It is only possible to piece together a surmise as to the meaning of it all. But the generally accepted theory that Dr. Patterson, annoyed by the boy's presence, found it easy to persuade himself that his wife was always worse after he had been there, and therefore forbade him in the house, is plausible. There seems, however, to have been quite definitely another reason. It was Mahala. She was well over 40 and had no children of her own, and had had George with her almost continually since he was a baby. It was more possible that the prospect of losing him, as she saw the boy becoming more and more attached to his mother, was more than she could bear to contemplate. Only, indeed, on some assumption can be explained what quickly followed Dr. Patterson's drastic action. Mrs. Eddy, in retrospection and introspection, says her husband was unwilling her son should have a home with her, and adds, "A plot was consummated for keeping us apart. The family to whose care he was committed very soon removed to what was then regarded as the far west. We never met again until he had reached the age of 34. She does not say how she bore up or went down under this latest blow, but it was soon after the departure of the Cheneys, they went to Minnesota, that an incident occurred which, in view of what was to follow in Mary's life, has a significance all its own. In the long days and often nights she spent reading, she devoted herself to just two subjects, religion and medicine. She read the Bible, as she had always done for long hours together. But now she also studied any book she could get on homeopathy. Daniel Patterson, as has been seen, practiced homeopathy to a certain extent, and from the first, its study seems to have had a particular fascination for Mary. This was, no doubt, partly due to the fact that she hoped by studying the system herself to discover some cure for her own troubles, such as her husband had not been able to find, but also because, in its early days, homeopathy frankly presented a mental and even a spiritual element calculated to make strong appeal to a woman of Mary's mentality and background. In his monumental work on the subject, Der Organon der Rationellen Heilkunde, in which he expounded his system, Friedrich Heinemann was quite definite on this point. The Organon was first translated into English about 1825, a few years after the study of homeopathy had first been introduced into the United States by a Danish doctor, one Hans Busch Gram. The system, although bitterly opposed by the orthodox medical profession, gained ground rapidly. Curiously enough, the date of its formal introduction to each state is on record. And the spread is remarkable, running from New York in 1825 to Iowa in 1871. Homeopathy reached New Hampshire as a serious study about 1840. And at the time Mary Patterson was passing through such deep waters in the little house at North Groton, some 15 years later, it was definitely coming into favor as a remedial agent. The Organon had reached several editions. Hahnemann had by that time been dead many years, and two bitterly opposed schools of thought had arisen in the practice of his system, the Hahnemannians and the Rationals. Hahnemann had definitely laid it down in his Organon that, although drugs might be the medium, the actual healing agent was purely mental and spiritual. "It is only," he wrote, "by means of the spiritual influence of a morbific agent that our spiritual power can be diseased, and in like manner, only by the spiritual operation of medicine can health be restored." The Hahnemannians accepted this teaching implicitly, regarded the Organon as their Bible, and insisted, as they still insist, that the doctrine of the spiritual dynamization acquired by trituration and succession as indubitable. The Rationals, on the other hand, maintained that the spiritual side of the remedy, if it existed at all, was only part of the cure, and that they were free to use all adjuvants known to science. Mary Patterson was absorbingly interested in the whole subject, as is shown by her many allusions to the matter in the course of her writings, and especially by one case of cure in which she herself was the practitioner. This she describes in detail. No date is given, but it is more than possible that it was one of her experiences while at North Groton, as it is known that while there, although she did not seem to be able to help herself, she tried to help others through homeopathy. The case she describes is one of dropsy. "We prescribed for her the fourth attenuation of argentum nitricum, with occasional doses of high attenuation of sulfurous. She improved perceptibly. It then occurred to us to give her unmedicated pellets for a while and watch the result. We did so, and she continued to gain, as before, and finally said she would give up her medicine. But the third day she suffered and was relieved by taking it. She went on in this way, taking the unmedicated globules, with occasional visits from us, employing no other means, and was cured." This was written in 1881, but the episode is retained in the present version of Science and Health, page 156. What actual effect this or other similar experiences had upon Mrs. Patterson at the time, it is difficult to say. Everyone is inclined to read into the past the convictions of the present, and these later accounts by Mrs. Eddy of her earlier experiences are generally designed to enforce an argument which was quite admittedly a later attainment. One cannot be sure that she even caught a glimpse at the time of that which later on she saw so clearly. The fact, however, that when writing of her discovery, she had been trying to trace all physical effects to a mental cause, would seem to indicate that this was at least a highlight in her study of homeopathy. Mrs. Eddy leaves no doubt in her later writings that this study helped her, was indeed a definite step onwards. But that it failed even to help her at North Groton is made clear by the rather pathetic story of how one day she consoled her little blind maid, who had dropped and broken a bottle of very highly considered homeopathic medicine, by saying that it was no good anyway. The woman with the dropsy might be cured by the faith begotten of a kindly deception. But Mary Patterson could not deceive herself, and so the remedy was no good. She was, however, before she left North Groton, to receive another glimpse of the power of faith, this time in herself, so vivid as to leave upon her mind an impression which remained through the years and reappeared as a witness later on. Not far from her home in North Groton, there lived a retired minister, a devout old man, well over 90. He was known as Father Merrill, and day after day he would walk over to the Patterson home to visit Mrs. Patterson, who, after her son was gone, was bedridden most of the time, and the two would read the Bible and pray together. One day, as he turned in at the gate from the road, to his complete surprise, he looked up and saw Mary, all smiles, with arms outstretched, coming down the path to meet him. With Father Merrill, there was no doubt as to what had happened. He cried out at once with joy, "Praise God, he has answered our prayer." Mary, for the time, was equally joyous and equally sure that it was an answer to prayer. But that she was unsatisfied, restlessly insistent on knowing the why and how of it all, is made clear from her later experience. She could not hold on. The blind faith of the old minister could not be hers, any more than could the faith of the woman sick of the dropsy. And so she sank back again. And now things went from bad to worse. Patterson was away most of the time, but he earned less and less until even the interest on the mortgage was a long way in arrears. Abigail could, of course, have saved the situation, and was no doubt appealed to, but to her practical mind it had long since become apparent that the enterprise in North Groton was a failure, that Mary was drifting into a state of chronic invalidism, and that the best thing for all concerned was to let the holder of the mortgage foreclose. Under the date of September 29, 1859, Mrs. Patterson recorded in her notebook, "On this day, my sister sells our homestead." For the holder of the mortgage was none other than Martha Pillsbury. Abigail's intentions were no doubt good, but she left Mary to wring from the situation the last drop of humiliation and suffering. It was not until the actual day of the foreclosure that she came over in her carriage from Sandbutton to take her sister away. Nor was this all that Mary was to bear helplessly. When one Joseph Wheat with whom Dr. Patterson had quarreled, heard about this, he gleefully dispatched his son, Charles, to toll the church bell mockingly, until the tormented Mary was well beyond reach of its clangor. As they drove slowly down the mountain towards Rumney, the little blind servant trudged some way behind. She would not ride or come too near the carriage. She could not bear to hear the low sobbing of her mistress as she leaned wretchedly on Abigail's shoulder.